Item one, told you so. Item two, how about all those government regulations? Item three, sports stadia. From American Public Media, this is Market Flags. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today the 11th of July. Good as always to have you along. We said yesterday, right about at this point in the program, that a whole lot of what's going to happen in economic Washington the rest of the year, that is tax reform, raising the debt limit, the very funding of the government, was going to depend on what gets done or doesn't get done in the next 3 weeks. That is, before Congress takes its August recess. Just a quick update here to point out that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell was obviously listening and agrees. Today, McConnell said he was going to push back the Senate's vacation 2 weeks so that the GOP can figure out its health care bill. Rumor has it that we, that is the American public, will get to see the latest version on Thursday. Down at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, meanwhile, no, not that story. There is news of banking regulation. President Trump has said Congress, his first nominee for the Federal Reserve, Randall Quarles, to be Fed vice chair for supervision. That is the central bank's top banking regulator. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganzer takes a look at what his priorities might be and what he might be able to actually get done.
The Fed vice chair of supervision post was developed as part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law, but Quarles will be the first person to hold the job, provided he's confirmed by the Senate. Frank Notaft is chief economist at CoreLogic. He thinks Quarles will push for changes in how parts of Dodd-Frank are enforced.
He has felt that the Fed has been just overly aggressive in the past in how it's enacted rules, and he's felt that it's been overly constraining, especially for the large banks.
Specifically, Notaft expects Quarles to push for changes in enforcement of the Volcker Rule, which limits or prevents banks from using their own money for certain investments. Now, Quarles would also be a member of the Fed Board of Governors and would get a vote on interest rates. He's written in favor of a strict formula he believes the Fed should follow on interest rates. Lindsay Piegza is chief economist at Stifel Fixed Income.
He's looking for a hard line on inflation, a hard line on growth, and taking those two into account, forcing the Fed's hand one way or the other.
The Fed has considerable wiggle room right now, although it does have targets for inflation and unemployment. Eric Stein of Eaton Vance Management says Quarles might end up wanting some wiggle room. He says people can change once they're in the Fed hot seat.
Then when they actually get to the Fed and they deal with the issues of being at that institution and being accountable for monetary policy, sometimes views can change.
Whether his views evolve or not, Quarles couldn't make major changes at the Fed all by himself. He'd have to work with the other Fed governors and Fed Chair Janet Yellen. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There is another slightly more obscure but equally important regulatory appointment in the news to tell you about. Naomi Rao has been confirmed by the Senate to head up the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, a key job in this deregulatory presidency. Marketplace's Jed Kim has that one.
When federal agencies put together major new regulations, they run cost-benefit analyses. The Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, or OIRA, essentially checks their math. Philip Wallach is with the Brookings Institution. He says the office has a big task ahead of it, navigating an executive order signed by President Trump that says for every new regulation, agencies have to scrap two old ones.
There's a lot of very hard questions to answer in terms of how that system is going to work and whether it's going to effectively just amount to a regulatory moratorium where they're just not putting out new rules.
Naomi Rao teaches law at George Mason University. One of the areas she focuses on is constitutional law. She once clerked for Clarence Thomas. Kent Lassman is president of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's excited at the prospect of Rao at the helm of OIRA.
The core of her work and her career and her scholarship has been on political accountability. And that's something that I think is horribly missing today in our regulatory processes.
Robert Weissman is president of Public Citizen, a progressive public interest advocacy group. He's worried
that this will be the agency that really drives forward Trump's anti-regulatory zeal, which means, in practice, making America less safe, less healthy, and more open to corporate crime and abuse.
With all the attention on regulations, the once obscure OIRA is set to take center stage. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, not really a high-quality day, actually. Traders plotzed just a little bit after the Trump Jr. email story broke, mostly collected themselves by the closing bell. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Not to get all Lion King on you here, but there is a circle of life in business just like there is in the rest of the world. Companies are born and they die. But sometimes, like now in this economy, companies are dying faster than they're being created. That's the upshot of a study by the Economic Innovation Group. John Letteri is a co-founder and the director of policy there. John, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Guy.
What does it mean that companies are dying faster than they're being formed?
Well, what it means is that for the first time on record in 2009, after the Great Recession, we saw the birth rate of firms, the startup rate, cross below the death rate of firms. That had never happened before, even in a single year. And it happened for three consecutive years, 2009, 2010, 2011. And the hole that we dug was deep enough such that in 2014, which is the latest year the data is available, we had fewer total firms in the economy than we had in 2007. Even though the economy itself had grown by more than $1 trillion in GDP. That's a big deal because the downstream impact of a missing generation of what we roughly estimate is 1 million missing firms that should have been born during that period is really profound when you think about the labor market implications, the competition implications within industries, the wage growth implications. If you have fewer firms competing for workers, there's just less of a reason to do certain things in the economy that we've traditionally been able to rely upon.
A million firms is X million jobs. That's what it means tangibly, right?
That's right. I mean, new businesses are the source of the vast majority of net job creation. So established companies of basically all sizes and shapes tend to shed jobs more than they create them in any given year. It's that cohort of new firms in the economy that tend to be the big job creators. So if you're startup engine is breaking down, your job creation engine is breaking down as well.
Is this widespread across the country, or did you look at major metropolitan areas? Is it a rural-urban thing? What is it?
We've looked at every sector of the economy and every region of the economy, and it's widespread. With the startup rate being low, the overall number of new businesses being added to the economy has gone way down. This is the slowest period of net growth in terms of businesses that we've ever seen. And so the pie is getting smaller, but the slices are relatively bigger to the big super-performing metro areas. So we looked at how many metros accounted for half of the national increase of firms after the recession. Five metros alone did as much as the rest of the country combined. That's just staggering. We've never seen anything like that.
So New York, Miami, just reading off the report. New York, Miami, Los Angeles, Houston, and Dallas are all good. But if I'm in, say, Duluth, Minnesota, or the outskirts of, you know, Jackson, Mississippi, or wherever, I'm in some trouble.
You're in some trouble. We definitely see a reward to density. These larger, denser metro areas.
Good phrase, reward to density, yeah.
Are doing well. And it's not that smaller metros in isolation aren't doing well. You look at places like Salt Lake City or Provo or Austin, their startup rates are really strong. It's that they don't have the scale that a place like New York or Boston or Miami. But regardless, the historical precedent has not been to have so much of net national business growth coming from such a small number of places. It's not a blip. It looks like we're settling into this new normal of kind of a narrow swath of people, places, and firms accounting for a huge proportion of the national growth story. And that's why if you live outside of one of those high-performing areas, the story that they're hearing for years about the national recovery, the worst being behind us, kind of the rising tide, just never resonated with many people for good reason. Right. It wasn't their local experience.
John Letteri, he's a co-founder and director of policy at the Economic Innovation Group. The report in question, we'll have a link to it on our website. It's actually fascinating. It's called Dynamism in Retreat. John, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
Oh, Major League Baseball convenes in Miami this week for the All-Star break. The Home Run Derby last night, the All-Star game itself tonight. Celebrations aplenty, of course, but the actual venue, Miami's Marlins Park, is a bit of a sore spot for some locals. Tax dollars helped pay for the thing just a couple of years ago. New digs to convince the team to stay put, as the excuse always goes. Now, though, there is talk the Marlins might be sold, leaving Miami with a new, pricey, and possibly empty stadium. It's not an uncommon story, taxpayer money being spent on private sports arenas. Now, though, a federal bill aims to curb some public funding for those shiny new stadiums. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains.
Every day, Kirk Howard pushes his 18-month-old son in a stroller in Englewood, just south of L.A. He likes to walk past the L.A. Forum, the famous former home of the L.A. Lakers.
You know, you think of Englewood, you know, it's the Forum. You think of the great Lakers that back in the day.
The Lakers moved to the Staples Center downtown back in 1999. But now Englewood's getting a new life in sports, right across the street. Los Angeles Stadium at Hollywood Park is where NFL teams the Rams and Chargers will play starting in 2020. Howard's fine with the construction noise and traffic.
I mean, at the end of the day, providing jobs for the city of Englewood, you know, new stores, you know, a whole new environment. I think it's worth it. Yeah, I think it's worth it.
The developers have promised 3,500 construction jobs and 10,000 more jobs at the stadium, plus the shops, restaurants, and office space attached. LA officials promised not 1 cent of tax money would go toward the new Hollywood Park. That's unusual. Most professional sports arenas get financed with tax-exempt bonds. Jeffrey Dorfman is an economist at the University of Georgia. He explains.
A city or county agrees to pay for some or all of a stadium and uses their power to issue municipal bonds. And so those are tax-free, generally from state, local, and federal income tax.
There's a recent paper from the Brookings Institution on this with a very clear title, Why the Federal Government Should Stop Spending Billions on Private Sports Stadiums. Ted Geyer's a co-author. He says since the year 2000, new stadiums or major renovations have gotten $3.2 billion in federal help.
Because the local government is subsidizing these stadiums to attract teams, the federal government then subsidizes them through these municipal bonds.
The New York Yankees' 2009 stadium, he says, cost $2.5 billion. About 70% was financed by tax-exempt municipal bonds, with $492 million in tax revenue lost. Why would cities do this? The NBA, NFL, MLB, all the pro leagues allow only a certain number of teams. Lots of cities want one, so supply and demand.
As long as supply remains less than demand, the team owners are able to threaten to move from their existing city to a different city in exchange for substantial amounts of funding.
Mark Edelman teaches sports law at Baruch College in New York.
This creates a prisoner's dilemma for mayors and other leaders of cities, where the fan base does not want to lose the team.
But cities are only willing or able to offer so much to try to keep them. They can up the ante through bigger and bigger tax breaks. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker and Oklahoma Senator James Lankford want to put a stop to the tax breaks. A bill they've introduced would ban tax-exempt municipal bonds for pro sports stadiums. Jeffrey Dorfman at the University of Georgia is a fan.
Is there any rational argument for why the government would want to bestow tax-free status on these bonds? I don't think there is.
But he says sports stadiums have been treated like public infrastructure since the 1950s. Team owners and developers have argued successfully that new stadiums are a public good. They spur more economic activity in restaurants, hotels, conventions. Dorfman says no.
That's really an incorrect argument. There's no economic growth being generated by pro sports teams.
No growth, he says, above and beyond any big retail or entertainment project.
We would have spent that going to the movies or some other dinner or other vacation anyway.
And when a team leaves, the gap is particularly hard to fill. Just ask San Diego. Last year, taxpayers there decided not to fund a new stadium to keep the Chargers. Now San Diego's Qualcomm Stadium has to find a second life as the new Hollywood Park in Inglewood takes in the Chargers, across from its elderly cousin, the once great Western Forum. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I had been digging around on the internet basically in a fit of frustration.
Yeah, been there. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up less than a point today, flat. We call that close at 21,409. NASDAQ up 16 points, about 0.2%, 6,193. S&P 500 pretty much flat as well, 2,425. With all the regulatory news we were telling you about, let's check some bank and credit stocks, shall we? Citigroup dropped 1.2% today. Bank of America slipped 1 1/10. Chase down about 0.5% today. Visa, though, up 0.3%. MasterCard up 1 2/10% today. It is Amazon Prime Day, also known as a big pointless promo, and an occasion for that company to unload stuff that didn't sell in the past year. Amazon stock swung down 0.2% today. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.35%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The ticker symbol du jour on the big board is Snap, literally S-N-A-P, the parent company, of course, of Snapchat. The reference here, though, is not a positive one. Snap shares are trading below their initial public offering price back in March. That was $17, 15 bucks and change today. They had been as high as 29. The proximate cause, an analyst at Morgan Stanley, ironically the company that underwrote Snap's IPO, although underwriters are separate from the analyst. But one analyst said, quote, "We were wrong about the company's ability to keep advertisers happy. There have been other doubts as well in what could be turning into a case of buyer's remorse," as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
With tech stocks, there's a three-part recipe for success. Part one, you need a clearly defined business model. Part two, growing engagement with users. And part three, a clear path toward profitability. All things that Piper Jaffray analyst Sam Kemp says Snap hasn't delivered yet.
I think those are really the things that Snap has been tripped up on, is it has a model that has not yet been proven out from an advertising standpoint. It has user growth that is stagnating and potentially slowing.
Wait, come again? How did Snap, one of the hottest tech stocks since Facebook, end up behind the eight ball like this? Well, some of these risk factors, such as subscriber growth, were already flagged in the company's stock prospectus.
We did start to see that trend already in the back half of 2016. Some of that we think was impacted by Instagram.
Aaron Kessler is a managing director at Raymond James. He says a big problem for Snap is the fact that its chief competitor, Instagram, also rolled out its own Snap-like feature called Stories. As of June, Instagram had about 250 million daily users, about 100 million more than Snap. So how does the company get its mojo back?
Continue to innovate the product, to make also the product more attractive to a larger demographic, including older users who may not be using the product today.
Translation, millennials alone can't carry the water for Snap forever, but given that the company's only been public for about 3 months, they still have some time to make adjustments. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
A quick peek at the gas pump tells you all you need to know about the global price of a barrel of crude. Although there was a bump up today, oil prices are low and likely, according to a slew of forecasts from Wall Street banks to the Department of Energy, they are likely to go lower. The most dramatic projection was a call from Goldman Sachs that oil is going to fall from 45-ish or so a barrel today to sub-40 territory, which means exactly what for the companies leading the U.S. energy boom? Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one from the sustainability desk.
It's been this way for 3 years. The world has too much oil. Now, OPEC and the Russians tried to fix that by freezing supply late last year. But globally, the dam has now broken, says Colin Smith at the London brokerage Panmure Gordon.
The growth in U.S. production provides a background for weakness. But just recently, the big swings in global production have been coming out of OPEC itself, more production from Libya and from Nigeria.
Libya and Nigeria were exempt from the OPEC freeze. But now there are signs that other members of the cartel are producing over quota. They're cheating for quick profits, helping to flood the market. Now, low prices hurt American frackers because they spend a lot of money to produce a barrel of crude. Still, they're fracking away, says analyst Joseph Tripke at infillthinking.com.
It's sort of every producer for themselves. No one thinks they're going to fail, right? No one thinks they're going to go bankrupt or not be able to meet their debt obligations. And so everyone is producing as fast as they can, and that's kind of the mentality.
Also, many U.S. shale producers keep fracking because they pre-negotiated a higher price. So again, not slowing down, says Princeton Energy Advisors Stephen Kopitz.
And the shale operators routinely shoot themselves in the foot because they're all, you know, optimists. They love to go out and drill, and then they all drill together, and then suddenly we have too much oil. So it's a really standard boom and bust thing.
Of course, with oil, you never know. Some shock to the market could always be coming. But for now, many are planning for another bust. the second in 3 years. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Jed Kim was talking up at the top of the program about federal deregulation and how the White House is keeping tabs on it. There is a story in the New York Times today, joint project of the Times and ProPublica, about how deregulation is being executed in the various executive departments and agencies and by whom. Danielle Ivory is with the New York Times. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell me about these deregulation teams that are spread through the government.
Sure. Well, so Donald Trump signed an executive order in February of this year, basically ordering agencies to create these deregulatory task forces. And they're being set up at all of the major agencies. And their mission is to find regulations that could be reduced or rolled back. And this isn't a new thing. Other administrations have also looked at regulations. But in this case, it's a little bit different because these agencies have really empowered a lot of political appointees, and many of them come from business backgrounds.
Well, so tell me about some of those folks. Tell me about who is on these teams, what their backgrounds are, and why that is interesting.
Sure. So we have identified 71 appointees thus far, and 28 of those we found had potential conflicts. Some of them had come from industries where they had actually worked for employers who had tried to get regulations rolled back, and now they're working at those agencies.
Tell me then about, just to pick one, Samantha Dravis. She chairs the deregulation team at the EPA.
Right. So Samantha Dravis was a top official at the Republican Attorneys General Association, and she was also president of the Rule of Law Defense Fund. And that brought together energy companies and Republican attorneys general to file lawsuits against the federal government over environmental regulations during the Obama administration. So it is notable that she's on a task force that is going to be looking at what regulations, environmental regulations, could be rolled back.
Let me ask you a question about methodology here. You say there was not a lot of response from these agencies. You point out that you dug through like 1,300 pages of handwritten sign-in sheets, I think, from the Department of the Interior, where, you know, you go to an office and you sign in and you say where you're from and who you're visiting. There is a certain amount of we don't know what we don't know here, right?
Yeah, there is. I mean, we've asked the agencies to provide us with correspondence and calendars and other information about these task forces. In some cases, agencies haven't even told us who's on the task force. So, I mean, we're just trying to get whatever information we can. I'm so glad that you brought up the sign-in sheets. I had been digging around on the internet, basically in a fit of frustration, trying to find more information about one of the interior appointees, and stumbled across these visitor logs, which are very messy. They're handwritten. And so we just went through them and backgrounded every single person who had met with a task force appointee.
So if I'm a company an interest group, it is worth money to me to be able to get in front of these people.
Absolutely. Companies are spending money in order to get to the front of the line. It takes a long time for regulations to be put in place. So getting to the front of the line while this administration is young is very important to companies.
Danielle Ivory, she works at the New York Times. Danielle, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, file under, I am not making this up. Nevada has declared a state of emergency because there is not enough pot. Recreational marijuana has been legal in Nevada since July the 1st. Business has been so good at pot shops, though, that supplies are running short, hence the emergency declaration last week from the Nevada Department of Taxation and the governor, which would allow for more authorized retailers to get into the market. Legal pot, of course, means taxable pot. Nevada is counting on $100 million marijuana tax dollars in its 2017 budget. I keep telling y'all, it comes down to economics. All right, we are leaving. We're out of here. We're done. The Dow flat today. The NASDAQ up 0.2%. S&P 500 flat, flat, flatty, flat, flat. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tem, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.